Today, with the approval of the minutes, has anyone had time to read these very detailed minutes? Representative Solberg?
Yeah, I have.
Okay, Representative Solberg moves approval of the minutes.
With a great deal of trust to the clerks.
Great ability. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All say no. Minutes are approved. Item 4 is the continuation on the Department of Administration overview. And we're going to be doing three things today. We are going to finish the conversation on the Drive to Excellence because we kind of rushed through that with the number of questions we had last week. We're going to talk about the real estate management function that the Department of Administration has and get a taste of how the leasing of state facilities works, rental agreements. We may have some questions on that. We're going to find out if we are making some progress and taking a look at the Ford building. I would ask members of the committee to think about the bonding recommendations for this committee are being requested to be forwarded to capital investment by February 4th. And Mr. Jordal ran upstairs, but we're probably be having capital investment hearings next week, would be my guess. Representative Irv Anderson has a bill on the World War II Memorial. We'll probably let him do a presentation on that. And then we're going to have to make some decisions on if the committee wants to deny funding for any of the projects for bonding. If this committee makes a decision to blackball a project that cannot be included in the capital investment bill going out of committee when Representative Dorman gets his bill put together, so we have to make a decision on that. There was a project last year that fit in that. And then I think what we'll do is similar to what we did last time, which is we will recommend funding, not recommend funding or blackballing, and then we'll maybe have some neutral recommendations that the committee on capital investment can review and do with it what they want.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, yes, Mr. Representative Solberg.
Do we have a list of bills that have been referred right now to the committee on that topic? And if we do, can we at least have can you share with us in advance?
Ms. Roberts, do you know the bills that we have referred to us relating to capital investment? I know Mr. Jordal would know off the top of his head.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I don't know off the top of my head. But other than the World War II, and I believe that Representative Solberg also has a bill.
Oh, do I?
Oh.
But Mr. Chair, it would be kind of nice to kind of know so we can have a little bit of advance knowledge.
Right. And I think, Representative Hilty, if you know any members of your caucus who have bills relating to state government finance capital projects, if you'd spread the word that we're going to be doing this quickly, they really should get their bills in soon. I would say by Monday they should all be in because we need to get moving on those. The Senate's already passed their bloated bill, and so we need to get moving on that.
Well, that's an editorial, Mr. Chair, that may or may not be true.
Depends what the definition of bloat is. The next item that we're going to talk about is professional and technical contracting, and some members have had questions about how this functions. And Mr. Shepard is going to, under item 5, do an overview of the laws relating to state contracting, and there's actually more than what a person might think, and I think there's some items in our packet relating to that, but we're going to talk a little bit about that and how it works. And then Mr. Shepard will give us his presentation and we'll be done. If we'd have the Department of Administration come forward on the Drive to Excellence. So Commissioner, are you up today or are we going to have several people up today on finishing? Okay. Okay. Well, whoever's wanting to come forward, have a seat and introduce yourself and your title for the tape. And let's talk about the Drive to Excellence a little bit more, shall we? We rushed a little bit too fast, I think, last week where people were not able to soak in everything that was going forward. Some members have questions on how the contract actually worked, and so we'll be getting to that soon. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee. If you'd introduce yourselves and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kent Allen. I'm the Director of the Materials Management Division within Administration.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Scott Brenner, Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. At least that's my day job. I also serve as the Steering Committee Chair for the Draft Excellence Initiative.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, on the first slide, you'll see a little bit about the background on the Drive to Excellence and the cost and the source of the funds for the Drive to Excellence. The state contracted with Deloitte Consulting for $2.5 million for this initiative. The money came from the InterTechnologies Group's retained earnings. There were consultations with a number of entities with respect to the use of that money for this project, including the Department of Finance. And this is something that was kicked off in the spring of 2004 under the leadership of Commissioner Brian Lamb of administration. I'm going to talk a little bit about the chronology of events and some of the steps that we took to try to ensure a contracting process that was above reproach. In April of 2004, Commissioner Lamb certified that he intended to engage in this contracting activity and agreed that it would be done in a way that's consistent with the 16C requirements that Mr. Shepherd will be talking to you about a little later this morning. The certification process is the first stage of any professional technical contracting process, and it requires a formal statement in writing regarding the intent of the project, the anticipated outcomes, some of the methods that will be used to ensure compliance with 16C, for example, how the contract will be advertised to the public, how performance under the contract will be monitored, and so forth. Following that formal certification of intent, the commissioner published two notices in the State Register, and they dealt with two potential contracting opportunities with the state. At this point in time, the Drive to Excellence was actually subdivided into two projects, and one was billed in the State Register as the state agency's Business Analysis and Recommendations Project, and the second, State Agency's Technology Analysis and Recommendations Project. Responses to this these two RFPs were due mid-May of 2004. We got responses from 11 businesses, six of whom responded to both the RFPs, and five of whom responded to only one. It was a wide mix of large and small companies. Generally, the larger companies responded to both the RFPs. In fact, the ones that responded to both were Accenture, Charter Solutions, Cisco Systems, Dell Marketing, Deloitte, a coalition of IBM, Bearing Point, and Public Strategies, and Unisys. And then companies that responded to either one or the other were Advanced Strategies, Endurant Business Solutions, Insight Solutions, Cavio Technology, and Compass. The responses to the RFPs were evaluated by a multi-agency staff team and evaluated to the terms published, the evaluation terms published in the RFPs. Specifically, 10% of the weight of the evaluation went to the company history and financial stability. Another 10% went to the references that we were able to obtain with respect to the prospective vendors. 20% went to cost. 20% went to the number and quality of the individuals assigned to the project. And 40% of the evaluation weight was awarded based on a work plan presented and the assessment tool that was offered as part of the program. Interestingly, the evaluation group ranked the same three providers as the top-ranked providers on both sides of the evaluation, both the business and the technology side. And those top three were Accenture, the consortium of IBM, Bearing Point, and Public Strategies, and Deloitte. So by June 8th, the department, working primarily through the Office of Technology, was able to announce the three finalists. They were notified of their status, and the non-finalists were also notified of their status. The finalists came in for a question and answer period with the evaluation group and then went on to a further evaluation that was conducted by commissioner level individuals from five or six agencies. By July 12th, that commissioner level evaluation group had recommended Deloitte as the top candidate, and so contract negotiations began with Deloitte. The primary issue initially was cost, and other issues included the respective responsibilities of the state and the vendors. The contract was ultimately executed on August 25th. Let me talk about some of the specific things that went into this to assure that the process was beyond reproach. One of the things that I already mentioned is that the criteria and the weight of the criteria were spelled out in some detail in the public notice in the State Register. One of the principles that we operate under is that all interested vendors have a right to equal and fair consideration for any state work. So obviously when you're awarding a high dollar state contract of this nature, you want to be sure that the selection process is as objective as it can possibly be, and totally legally defensible if anyone were to challenge the process. And publishing these criteria and the respective weights of the criteria is one of the important ways we try to do that. Puts all the parties on a level playing field and gives them notice of how they're going to be evaluated, what they should stress, what's important, what's less important. Another thing that I think is key to this particular vendor selection is that both the materials management division within administration, which is my area, and the Office of the Attorney General were actively involved in consultation roles as the Office of Technology did their work on this. Again, I think we all recognize that it was a high-stakes contract, and we couldn't afford to get hung up in legal disputes, and that's a key reason why the Office of the Attorney General was working with us behind the scenes. One of the things they assisted us on that was somewhat unique with respect to this project is that we developed what I think is the most detailed conflict of interest form that we've ever asked state evaluators to sign. Specifically, in May of 2004, Commissioner Lamb issued a memo to all of the individuals that could be taking part in in the evaluation and required them to attest to a number of things. One of those is that they'd read all the Minnesota statutes that relate to ethics and conflict of interest with respect to procurement. They also had to attest to the fact that they'd reviewed the list of all the responders who were interested in the project, and to then indicate whether they could say with confidence that they had no conflict of interest with respect to any of those responders, to say that they had or could be perceived to have a conflict of interest, in which case they would have dropped out of the process, or they could say they're uncertain whether they have a conflict and ask the Department of Administration to make a determination as to the appropriateness of them staying involved. If they believe they have no conflict, they then had to go on and indicate that either they have no current business relationship with the responding vendors and they agree that they won't have any communication with those vendors except in the context of the formal evaluation process, or if they do have a business relationship with any of those vendors, to indicate which vendor that is, what the business relationship is, and to attest that they won't have any independent communication with the vendor outside of either the evaluation process or that existing business relationship. They also had to attest that they understand that the responder proposals are non-public until the contract is awarded, agree not to disclose any non-public data to anyone, and certify to the Commissioner of Administration that they understand they have personal responsibility to ensure that their actions comply with the commitments they've made, and that they'll notify the Commissioner of Administration if their status changes in any way that could affect the conflict of interest statement that they've made. So all the evaluators signed that appropriately. Another thing that we did to try to ensure the absolute, the best possible neutrality of the process was to ensure that if any one of the vendors received any information, that we immediately supplied it to their competitors. So, for example, after the question and answer sessions that were held with each of the parties the very next day, all of the information that was provided to any one of those vendors was summarized in a letter form and sent to all of the finalists, so they all had the advantage of that same information. Another one of the areas where we worked closely with the Attorney General to try to ensure that we could keep as many competitors participating as possible is after receiving and reviewing these proposals, it was clear that many, if not most, of the vendors had put something in their proposal that, if it were not corrected, could actually have eliminated them from further consideration. So we worked with the Office of the Attorney General and developed what was essentially a responsive letter to each of those vendors that called their attention to the things that they had put in their proposal that, if not corrected, could actually bounce them out of the process. So, for example, a number of vendors had said they would only participate if they could be assured that they wouldn't be eliminated from consideration for future state work because of a perception of an organizational conflict of interest. So what we told those vendors is that we will, all interested vendors, that we can't make an absolute guarantee going in that in a future fact situation we can determine that there would not be an organizational conflict of interest, and so we cannot give them the absolute assurance they were seeking that they could never be rejected from future work. So essentially we said you either have to rescind that requirement on your part or you're out of the process. And people tended to then rescind with that understanding. Others had marked everything in their proposals as proprietary or trade secret or confidential. And we communicated to them that under state law, only certain things can be protected as trade secrets. And so they had to withdraw that absolutely blanket requirement in order to continue in the process. Some had taken exception to terms and conditions in the state's boilerplate language that are statutorily required. So in those cases, we informed them that the particular things, including issues relating to workers' compensation, retainage, state audits, and so forth, that we cannot negotiate because they're statutorily required. Again, they were told you must either withdraw that requirement or not go forward in the process. And then lastly, some vendors had particular things built into their responses that they said were prerequisites to their participation that were in conflict with our standard terms and conditions. What we told them is if terms and conditions are not mandated by statute, they are negotiable, but we can't accept your terms and conditions as prerequisites to the selection process. And I believe in all cases with that additional information, the vendors corrected the responses in such a way that we could continue to evaluate them. Another thing that's somewhat interesting is that we had these two totally separate tiers of evaluators, and they both ultimately selected the same top candidate. Both the staff group and the commissioner level group separately rated Deloitte as the top-ranked responder, which one would hope is a good indication that the evaluation process was reasonably effective. And in this case, it hasn't been challenged by any of the unsuccessful responders. As the commissioner level group met on this, one of the things they concluded was that we could conceivably reduce the overall cost of the project if the two proposals be combined and awarded to a single vendor. You may recall that it was the same, the top-ranked vendors had all responded to both parts of the RFP. There had been some consideration of awarding one component to one vendor and another to a second, but based on the evaluations and the sense that there could be a reduction in cost, Deloitte was offered both contracts.
Mr. Allen, What type of cost was originally estimated versus what was actually executed at the end of the day? Is 2.5 at the end? What kind of savings do you think you were able to glean out?
Mr. Chair, the response to the Deloitte's response to the RFP asked for $2.5 million for each of the components. So their total going into the negotiations was $5 million, and it was brought down to $2.5 million through the negotiation process.
Mr. Allen, you know, the question that is in my mind on this, and all these, you know, I'm not saying anything that's been done with the contract is, you know, bad or illegal or unethical. I think what you did is very, very thorough. I think the question that might be on the committee members' mind is, you know, let's say that you weren't able to negotiate the price down very much. Let's say it only went down $1 million and you had to pay $4 million. Where would the money have been lying around? Would this have been in the enterprise fund or the ITG fund? If the contract would have been $4 million instead of 2.5, we'd have just taken the money out of there. And I think the question then arises, the committee might want to spend some money on veterans or whatever, and maybe if there's all this money lying around in the ITG fund, instead of paying for contracts that nobody on the committee even really was aware of, maybe we would want to spend it on something else. Now, maybe I'm just totally on Pluto when I'm thinking this way, but that's kind of what's going through my mind is if the contract itself was $2.5 million and that's its own issue, but where would the money have come from if you weren't able to grind it down by $2.5 million?
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to tell you as much as I know about that, and if we need more detail beyond what I know, we should probably get Keith Payton involved, who is more directly tied to the negotiation process on cost. But my understanding is that Intertek, the Commissioner of Administration, and the Commissioner of Finance had determined that there was up to $2.5 million available in Intertek's retained earnings for use on this particular initiative. And so the state actually went into these negotiations with Deloitte with the understanding that $2.5 million was the most that it could conceivably spend on this initiative. And is that essentially correct? I see Keith Payton nodding yes, so. And that's about my depth of knowledge on that aspect of it.
Representative Prinky?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know who has the answers, but I always had this strange concept that the legislature had the power of the purse. And we have been struggling around here for several years. I get my colleagues over here say no.
After we go home.
Yeah. All right, yeah. We know that from past experiences, but and certainly have been here during times of sort of ubiquitous budgets when there were millions and millions of dollars, you know, sort of to be spread around to various programs. But my recollection is over the last few years, the budget's been a little tight, and we've been making some reductions in some places. And so for an agency to just say, well, we found this $2.5 million in a sock that we had behind the desk over in the corner is a little, I think, troublesome, I think, if I'm following the same line of thinking you are. So I'd like somebody, either Department of Finance or Department of Administration, to give us some more information about where we can find some more of those $2.5 million stocks that are just seem to be found after the legislature adjourns.
I'm not sure if Mr. Allen has the answer for where the multi-million dollar stock drawer is located, but potentially we will have some discussion in either in the future when the presentation is done. On, I would say the question is on the return to earnings of these enterprise funds is what the bottom line is, and I think that's where the legislature feels like a majority of the agency's budget is not general fund, and therefore it's very flexible, let's put it that way.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Solberg.
Would that be a tax called FEE? Is that generally that retained the earnings and enterprise funds are fees, right? Mm-hmm.
Whatever definition one you want to give it, potentially it's the interagency fees that are driving the budget intake there. Okay. So you could very easily characterize it as that.
Okay.
Representative Hilty, did you have your hand up?
No, I didn't.
Okay. Okay, why don't we move on to the next slide? We want to stay within our committee time frame this time, so we'll move on to the next one, Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, this is where I take over.
Oh, okay.
Once the contract was cut, a process was put in place to move the project forward. That's when a steering committee was set up. I'll talk a little bit more about the steering committee as we move forward. And I was asked to chair that steering committee. The process itself, which is still going forward, comprised itself of principally three components. It's shown here in a ready, set, go format. It was principally the ready format represents the data scan that took place in September and the first part of October. The set piece was the business case development followed by the go piece where the final recommendations will be made. This slide portrays from a staffing perspective how we work through the project with both Deloitte staff as well as state employee staff. The Deloitte team consisted of 31 FTEs, 15 national subject matter experts. They developed and executed the project's work. They did the day-to-day project management piece of the project. They had subject matter experts who led the surveying, interviewing, idea generation, and business case development teams. They provide national and international research and best practice measures, and they are still in the process of preparing the final document. With respect to state agency employees, team members consisted of 185 FTEs or half-time FTEs, a steering committee, and a variety of subject matter experts. They conducted surveys, did interviews, conducted research, developed opportunities and business cases, developed transformation roadmap recommendations, and directed project management team. They also set goals, direction, and approved results on behalf of the steering committee. From a governance perspective, this is how we developed. The steering committee, which comprised itself of 9 commissioners, including me, as well as the governor's office, reported directly to the governor's office. We had what we developed, an enterprise work group, which was principally the working arm of the steering committee. It was comprised of a variety of state employees, a number of state CIOs. There were 2 commissioners on that enterprise work group, both myself and Commissioner Badgero. And we provided almost daily guidance to what developed into 8 business transformation area groups, which are represented in green. These were the groups that worked through the business case development aspects of this project. This goes through the project timing. Phase 0, which was initiated when the contract was cut in August, the 25th of August. We moved straight into, within about 2 weeks, we moved into phase 1, where we took baseline measurements of where the executive branch is today and where we are today with respect to business process as well as our IT infrastructure. Through that period, there was also a significant number of interviews that took place with a variety of folks within the executive branch, both classified as well as unclassified individuals. And an initial list of opportunities was garnered through that process. Opportunities meaning what we thought would be good opportunities for the state to engage itself in in through this reformation stage. We compiled a list of approximately 450 opportunities.
Commissioner, when is that final report on the list of opportunities is going to be how to do things better, et cetera?
Mr. Chair, yes, I'm going. I'm moving into.
Okay.
That's right.
Thank you. Proceed.
Phase two was principally focused on ripening these 450 or so opportunities into more actionable business cases. So that list was shrunk from about 450 to 105, 106, something to that effect, which were really more mature ideas that came through that opportunity process. Those were finalized in 24 business cases, which were fairly broad-based in nature, fairly detailed in nature. That phase completed itself on December 17th, and then we entered into the final stage, which we're still working through, which was taking these business cases, synthesizing these business cases into an implementable governance structure, a financing scheme, as well as an implementation timetable. So that's the process that we worked through. That's the process we're still acting within. This gives you just a little clear indication of how we took a variety of ideas, moved them into opportunity areas, and then finally condensed those into actionable initiatives, leading to the synthesized product that we call the roadmap for the Drive to Excellence. This speaks to the deliverables, which we'll see soon. We're in the final stages of working through and editing through all this work product. But as a result of this process, we will have an as-is inventory of technology assets within the executive branch. We'll have an as-is business function inventory of the executive branch. We'll have a focused, collaborative, and managed process that evaluated the state's business and how to improve it. An actionable business case for 24 Minnesota governmental transformation initiatives, as well as a governance and funding model. So that's where we are today. We're working through that last product. What you'll see at the end of the day is basically a product that contains three primary components, one being an executive summary, one being what we call this roadmap, which is a synthesized work product. That's looking to be somewhere in the neighborhood of about 320 pages, followed by the business case work, which are these 24 business cases.
Commissioner, Representative Krinke has a question.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With question to staff, I believe at least 6 years ago, if not maybe even longer than that, did we not require an inventory technology from the Office of Technology? I'm kind of wondering, an as-is inventory, I mean, wasn't the, we, as I said, I know we had that in statute a number of years ago, so why are we paying $2.5 million to get at least a portion of what we were supposed to, the Office of Technology was already supposed to have?
Ms. Roberts, is this something in statute, or was it in session law, or a little of both?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krinke, that's in statute 16E.035, technology inventory, which states the Commissioner of Administration must prepare an inventory of technology owned or leased by state agencies. The inventory must include, one, information on how the technology fits into the state's information technology architecture, and two, a projected replacement schedule. The Commissioner must report the inventory to the legislative committees with primary jurisdiction over state technology issues by July 1st of each even-numbered year.
And Ms. Roberts, when was that, you have an idea when that was first put in the statute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krinke, in the 2001 session.
Mr. Chairman, so Mr. Penner, why do we say that under this contract we have what in statute has already been there for 4 years?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kroenke, I guess I can't speak to that. I can tell you from my perspective as Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry, I'm not aware of a list, an inventory list, prior to this process.
Well, Representative Solberg?
Mr. Chair, since it was supposed to be delivered every on July of every even-numbered year, has it been?
Mr. Jordahl, I didn't chair this committee as of July 1st, 2004. I don't see former Representative Haas sitting around here. Do you know if there was such a report delivered?
I apologize. It's not to say that it was not, but I'm not aware of such a report.
Mr. Shepard, you know? All right.
Chairman, can we find out?
I've never seen one.
Representative Hilty, were you the lead on this last time?
Yes, I was.
Who is the head of technology in the state? Is there someone in the audience who works in that office who might be able to give us a little idea of where this report may be, if anywhere?
Wouldn't there have been two reports in this? In the 02?
Potentially.
In 02 and in 04?
Okay, identify yourself for the record, and let's see if we can find the missing report.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Keith Patey. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Administration, but my primary role is that of the State Chief Information Officer. There is no report, and there has never been, to my knowledge, one delivered to the legislature. And that was one of the issues that we had. The assets for information technology are fairly widely scattered, dispersed, and I will say somewhat fragmented. And we came to the conclusion that we could not produce an inventory. Have not. This will enable us to begin to build the base for that inventory and to position ourselves to deliver on that in the future.
Well, Representative Kroenke, I'll give you the first opportunity.
Well, I think the reason that in 2001 that would have been back in the yesteryear when I chaired this committee, and I think some of us were aware that there was a certain amount of information lacking about technology, what we had, and what it was going to cost to replace, because we obviously had numerous requests from agencies for technology upgrades, improvements, and the like. So that was one of the reasons why the legislature acted, so that we could get a report. And I believe there was a report back in, might have been in 2002, but I'd have to go back and actually probably ask staff and people in the legislative library to go back and try and find one. But again, rather curious as to why the agency wasn't able to produce one when we asked for one, and I don't think we ever got a very clear response as to why they couldn't produce it. But
Mr. Payton, have you been with admin after July of 02?
Mr. Chair, no, I have not. I joined the Department of Administration as the state CIO a year ago in October.
Mr. Shepard, do you think you might be able to round up that report, whatever the latest was from the reference library, and give it to Mr. Jordahl to make copies of it for us? Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question. Mr. Payton, unless I heard you wrong, I thought I heard you say the report wasn't compiled because it was too difficult, but the Drive to Excellence apparently is going to be able to provide this inventory. What's different? Why weren't we able to inventory something a couple years ago, but we think we'll be able to do it now?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the observations and the recommendations that will be coming out in the roadmap phase will address that in some depth. The fact of the matter is that We have not as proactively managed all of the assets, IT assets, across all of the agencies as we could and should. And there's a, we believe, a wealth of opportunity to do that, and the recommendation of how to do that and how to govern this so that those assets are known and managed proactively will be a product of this study.
So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Pate, what I'm hearing then is that we don't have the know-how within state government ourselves to inventory our IT technology. What we have to do is get the knowledge from an outside consultant. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have pockets of know-how. It is our experience, having gone through this process in terms of trying to get the inventory, that it is very difficult to get it. It is very available in some agencies and not and sporadic in others. And we are coming to our own conclusions in that regard as part of the process right now.
Mr. Chair, just one final follow-up. Mr. Payne, do you know, are we finding out for the first time, we, the taxpayers, that this report that was required by statute to be delivered wasn't delivered? Is there any correspondence? Did anybody tell the legislature, hey, we can't comply with statute, or are we just finding out about it today?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure.
For committee members, I think we're going to dig up a little and see if we may have gotten a letter from Commissioner Lamb saying they weren't able to do it. We're not sure. We're going to check into that, but that'll be forthcoming. Representative Solberg? Mr. Payden?
Mr. Chair, I am drawing on my memory now, but I believe that early in my tenure, there was a letter produced from the Office of Technology indicating that the survey would not be delivered, but this process would deliver it, and tied that deliverable to this process, if my recollection is correct. But we'll find that ourselves.
Representative Solberg?
Mr. Chairman, it's kind of deja vu all over again. It's been a while since I've served on this committee, but when Representative Kahn chaired it back in the 80s, we had a similar type of discussion. And but my question is, did Deloitte actually do the survey of, or do the inventory? Are they doing the inventory?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are a number of different methods used to gather the information. We actually use some fairly sophisticated technical tools, which did electronic scans to get part of the information. The other part of the information was gathered through surveys and other mechanisms, and then that information was all tied together. So there are a number of different approaches used to gather the information, some of which was difficult to gather within the agency, and we used electronic scans to find out what assets we really did have.
No, my question is that a service then that Deloitte actually went out and did the scans and so forth? Their consultants were doing that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. The tools that they brought in were done through a subcontractor, which was part of the bid process, because we knew that much of the assets couldn't be found with just labor-intensive work. They were too varied, too dispersed, and so they part of their recommendation was to use electronic tools as well as to help us in the survey process.
Mr. Chairman, my last question is, what kind of a report? I think the most important thing that we in the legislature and hopefully administration get out of this is the recommendations on updating and replacement, and having some kind of a coordination of that instead of having each, as Representative Krinke said, each agency coming before us and saying our computer systems or our technology is out of date, fund us, and then they don't talk to anybody else. What kind of a plan does the administration have for updating, replacement, and the cost associated with that, and evaluating of that cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you've hit on a key critical issue. And we believe that there is a great opportunity in managing that issue just the way you suggested. And the recommendation will position us to if implemented, to be more proactive and aggressive and coordinated in that regard for periodic updates, knowledge of assets across agency, leverage of those assets across agency, as well as dealing with vendors in a more consolidated way when we do upgrade and do go to market to purchase.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't hit on that. That was something that Representative Kahn and former Representative Kruger suggested in 1988.
All right, anyone else? Well, we were on the next one. We're on focusing, collaborating, and managing. Representative Mallory.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to think here, and I guess my question is for Representative Krenke. When you required that, I assume that they considered it and decided whether or not there was extra money, and you either put it in or built it into their amount of money they got. I would think you probably did. Why are they requiring extra money to do it? Or why does it need extra money to do it?
Representative Krenke, was there an appropriation for this report, or did you just say get her done?
I don't recollect the discussions about the budget and whether this was within the budget of the Office of Technology, or whether I don't believe we appropriated any money beyond the general appropriation to the Department of Administration, which is obviously, as you know, fairly common. But I think Representative Solberg is correct in the historical perspective here. I think what we need to look at is that is the Office of Technology performing a function or not? And if the Office of Technology isn't, then we should get rid of the Office of Technology. I mean, this is what we set up the Office of Technology to do, and apparently over the last 15, 16 years, they haven't been able to perform what they were originally intended to do. And, I mean, Representative Kahn, I think if she were here, could go through sort of all the machinations of what we've tried to do to accomplish this end. But I think we should probably seriously look at this legislative session as to whether we should have an Office of Technology or not.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's one other problem, too, as I recall, and that is in setting up the Office of Technology, what we kind of asked them to do was to evaluate and give us and tell an agency, no, you're down the list a ways, or your plan for technology upgrades is not within this, what it should be. You're not providing a type of software that can talk to somebody else, or you're out by yourself. And quite frankly, I don't think they ever had the, in their defense, had the kind of authority for the agent to be over the agencies. And so the agencies would kind of bypass them and come and say, look how bad our equipment is, and somebody would fund it. In a little bit of defense of them, I don't think necessarily that they were given the authority that they probably needed or we envisioned them to have.
Representative Krenke?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, I think that was, again, part of the motivating process behind requiring a report statutorily, is to give the Office of Technology a little bit more clout in getting that information, saying, you know, we're statutorily required to report this, so therefore you need to give us the information, MnDOT or Department of Human Services or whomever, and obviously that didn't work.
Commissioner, we wanted to wrap up with this by 9:15 if possible, because we want to get into real estate, but if you could kind of go through your next items, and then we'll wrap up with any questions.
This is the last slide that I'm actually speaking to, and this just goes to how this initiative does differ in some respects to those in the past, and this goes to some of the debate that you're having right now. How do we expect this project to solve some problems that have been lingering, and we thought we'd resolve them with prior legislative enactment? So this speaks to that. To some degree, you will see out of this process a new governance design that we think enhances the IT, the centralized IT authority issue that
I believe Representative Solberg is absolutely correct on. The report, like I said, it's in final stages of edits. We hope to publicize it in the upcoming weeks.
Commissioner, you know, being that we're working with the state budget right now, there may be some helpful things coming out of this. We'll probably have to have a breakdown of, and I know someone from Deloitte's here, or if you're in charge since you're chairing it, but if there's some statutory recommendations on a lot of, I think all of us want excellent government, some of us want smaller government or less government, and I think if you've got some ideas on all of those items, we'd certainly like to help with implementing what works and make this work. The horse is out of the barn on this. We might as well make it work for the best of us. But I appreciate you coming in and sharing your process with us. Are there any last questions from committee members before we get to the Real Estate Management Division? Thank you, Commissioner. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
The next item is going to be the real estate management function of the Department of Admin. This includes selling land, buying property, and leasing and renting. And we've had some committee members interested in this role, and whoever is here from Admin that can give us an idea of how this works. Hopefully we'll have some good inquisitive questions from members of the committee. And we may have some questions. The governor's budget is being unveiled later today, but we'll have some questions on a big portion of what I saw when they briefed me on it relating to this committee that might blend in with this. I don't want to give away this big Manhattan Project secret that they've been hiding from everyone, but at the same point in time, there's some questions I think that are very relevant to building leases for the state. So if each of you could identify yourself and your title and then proceed with your presentation.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Nikki Giancola, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Administration for Facilities. And we wanted to cover a couple of things with you today as a follow-up to the prior meeting, one of which was how admin sets lease rates. The other thing that I think the committee wanted to hear about is how would those lease rates compare to both the state-owned and non-state-owned buildings. I think we're prepared to show you some of that, and in your packet you should have a couple of visuals of those. And then the third thing that I wanted to address with you all today is give you a couple options for a tour time for the Ford building, because I know that was something that we ended up with last time, and we are prepared with a couple of times for this committee, and hopefully we can get that done this week, because I know that we had gotten a message it would be best to get it done before February 2nd or 4th. So those were the key areas that we wanted to cover with you today. There are a couple of people here that I would like to introduce. Beverly Preuss is our division director for the Real Estate Management Division, and she can speak to the comparables, the leasing, and that type of thing. And I also have Lenore Madigan, who is the division director for plant management. And I just want to point out that it is the plant management division of the facilities department that sets and administers the lease rates for the state-owned buildings. So with that, I will turn it over to Lenora.
Good morning. If you could introduce yourself and your title and proceed.
I'm Lenora Madigan, and I am the...
If you could pull the mic up just real close.
Lenora Madigan, and I'm director of the Plant Management Division for the Department of Administration. Mr. Chair, committee members, there are... the state-owned buildings is what we're planning to talk about first. And under the state-owned buildings, the buildings that are managed or under the custodial control of the Department of Administration are there 20 buildings, and they are identified on the map in your packet. And it's the map that appears to be the 8.5 by 11 and shows the Capitol Complex. It also identifies buildings down here on the lower right that are outside the immediate Capitol Complex area. and it identifies the rental rates by building. Each biennium, admin sets rates for the buildings that we manage. The rates are based on the projected building expenses and essentially divided by the building square footage. Once admin sets the rates, the Department of Finance reviews and approves the rates. And after the rates are approved, admin notifies the agencies of what the rates will be. And the rates are set in the even years of the biennium. And this is done so that agencies can include them in their biennial budget planning.
Okay, for members of the committee, that's the document she's referring to is the one that's kind of on the bottom of your packet that says Plant Management Division Lease Rates. And it's got some color-coded maps inside here of all the buildings that we own and lease. So for members that are looking around, go ahead.
Okay. There are some differences in lease rates, and PMD sets rates a little different from the private sector, and I'm just going to try to highlight a few of the differences, and then Bev will talk about some more of them a little later in the presentation. One of the first differences is the bond interest. The bond interest is for construction projects funded with bonded dollars. PMD Plant Management Division averages the interest for the debt service and pays that over 20 years. Most of the money is paid to the general fund, with a small portion going to the facility and repair and replacement account within plant management. Another difference is the building depreciation. Building depreciation is calculated over the estimated life of the building. Most new buildings are depreciated over 75 years, and remodelings are depreciated over 30 years. Roof replacements are generally 17 years, and this money is either paid back to the general fund, the facility repair and replacement account, or the trunk highway fund, depending on the original source of the funds. There is some uniqueness of the buildings that we manage as well. The buildings that we manage, you can see on the map, they range from everything from the state capitol building to the history center to the governor's residence. And often, many of the buildings that we operate are not standard office buildings, and they require different service levels, such as the buildings I've just identified. PMD operates these buildings at appropriate levels with the owner-occupied focus on long-term benefits of maintaining and improving the buildings, as well as meeting the needs of the customers in that building.
You know, perhaps I'm too new at this to understand how lugubrious this process is, but we own the state capitol building, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Now, we charge the governor to stay in the state capitol building with his office and staff. Is that not correct?
Correct.
Why?
I think it was 1986... Mr. Chair, when the plant management became an internal service fund, one of the drivers was accountability for space, in terms of if you're actually paying for rent, you are more likely to be using your space wisely, whether you're in a public-owned building or in a private sector building. It was to equate the two processes together.
Okay. The second question is, this money is in one of the internal service funds. Is that used then for paying the custodians, the heat, the lights, or where's that money going off to? I know we had a hearing in Ways and Means yesterday about all the almost thousands of internal service funds. It's 40% of the state budget that people, you know, to be frank, don't pay any attention to. Wouldn't it just be wiser to not charge people to rent space in a building we own, and they're all government employees and so forth? What does the internal service fund pays for things? What does it pay for, and how much money is in it? And
The internal service fund does pay for all the expenses you've just identified, and they're highlighted on the next screen, but I'll talk about them right now. They include all salaries and benefits for the folks you've talked about, all the trade staff, all the janitorial, the groundskeepers, all of those folks. It includes their salaries and benefits. It includes all the utility costs for the buildings we maintain, so whether it's the air conditioning, the heating, repairs and maintenance to the facilities, the statewide indirect costs, maintenance and leasehold, insurance on the buildings, supplies to maintain the buildings. Those sorts of expenses are all included in this internal service fund. And the rates are established, as I just described earlier, where we look at the building's expenses and history and come up with the rate is. Then depending each year, 2 years when we set the rates, we look at what's the history of that building. And if there has been excess retained earnings, those ratings return, those go back to reduce that rate. So the earnings all stay within the fund, and they are used to set the lease rates.
Hey, what incentive? I mean, we had an incentive on, you know, supposedly people are frugal with their money, even though it's not their own, it's the government's. So I don't know what the incentive is on use of space. Interestingly enough, Representative Finstead and I go out to supper regularly, and we come back and see the Department of Transportation with every light in the building on every night, whether it's midnight, 2 in the morning, 5 in the morning. I'm not out that late, but you get the idea. If I come to the Capitol early, every light is on. If I go back to wherever we live, Kellogg Square, and it's 10:30 at night, every light is on. And I asked staff to follow up on this 2 years ago when every light was on 24/7 and asked, was this part of, you know, sometimes there's a way of heating a building with lights and so forth. That had nothing to do with that. It's people aren't shutting the lights off. They're not shutting their computers off. And there's no incentive for them to do so because it's not a business where it comes out of somebody's bottom line. It's just, well, the government can pay for it. How do you manage that? Obviously, it's not being managed. But, I mean, is there a way to... It bothers me. Let's just put it that way. Give me a little help on this. How do we send a message that we would like people to be frugal with the resources of government in tough times?
I think that, Mr. Chair, that is a message that we've received and understand and have been working both with our customers on changing hours of operations in facilities, not air conditioning on weekends when folks aren't around, and we have made strides in lowering our costs. And we, although we don't have that as a visual here today, we can show you where our lease rates have been and what they are today as we project them out for fiscal year 6 and 7. And we are doing reductions and managing the facilities. Mr. Chair, hear the from your staff regarding the DOT building and the lighting situation, and I did think that had been corrected, so I'll follow up on that with the lights on overnight.
I did notice, I think, 6 offices, probably Commissioner Molnow, because I used to sit by her on the floor and regularly complain to her about this, her and her secretary and probably the guy that is deputy. And so I've noticed a few going off. I think yesterday there were 7 or 8, but, you know, the rest... The other, how many stories up and how many windows wide we're all on, as well as the computer screens and everything else. So, you know, I don't want to be a micromanager, but it you know, it bothers me. Representative Mulery had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question was, you said if there's excess retained earnings, they reduce the rates.
That's correct.
Okay, so let's say by department or. Or how?
Mr. Chair, Representative, by building. The rates are set by building, and so each biennium then the rate would change for that entire facility. So in the case of the Centennial Office Building, if there were excess retained earnings, we would use those to lower the rate for the next biennium, and agencies would have that that information as they prepare their biennial budget information.
So,
Representative Mulery.
Mr. Chairman, so if... If we have a building that's one agency, let's say, so they get a certain amount of money assigned one biennium. They're very efficient. They take the Seifert plan and save money. Then their rate for that building is reduced in the following biennium, but then I assume that that is reflected in the governor's budget request so that the agency wouldn't really be the one that, if they, my understanding would be then if they took your advice, they wouldn't benefit from it. Is that correct?
Well, Ms. Madigan, you're saying that the following biennium, that everybody who leases out of that building has their rate go down.
Correct.
As individuals, they don't benefit, but as an agency, they may because their expenses for rent would go down, correct?
Correct, Mr. Chair and Representative, but exactly, and Department of Finance would be the one to speak directly about it, but that is exactly what was designed to happen, so that if there was a benefit, it wouldn't be budgeted at a higher level, so that we would keep the cost of the agency's budgets down as well, so that each year, each biennium, the rent level would be adjusted in correspondence with those rates.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I understand what's happening, but if, let's say there was one agency and they're just in one building and they are efficient, then their rates would go down, but wouldn't their budget then, my understanding, go down at the same time, so they wouldn't be. So the agency doesn't benefit from having a good policy of saving, because the amount of money that they get overall would go down equal to the amount of money they saved. Is that correct?
Well, not necessarily, Representative Mulder. I think correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Madigan. Is there a line item in the appropriations bills for what they pay in rent, or is that just part of the overall agency, quote unquote, agency budget that we hand over as a block? So
it's potentially, if we order the ladder.
If the governor wants to cut the agencies today, I don't know, whatever it is, 2-4%, let's say, this could be part of their way of saving money potentially to eat that 2-4% reduction.
You're correct, Mr. Chair. It's the latter, what you described.
Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Madigan, the way it's you have to help me out here since I'm really new to this, and this is a little bit different than the way the private sector works. But it sounds like you have what are essentially gross-type leases as opposed to triple net. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Which is fairly contrary. I mean, the vast majority of leasing in the private sector works off triple net primarily. Why not do that, for example, or triple net, for example, the Department of Transportation building, it's one of those things where you're a landlord. If you have a tenant who has already, quote-unquote, paid for your utility, sure, there's no incentive to be frugal with those particular utilities. So why not do triple net leases, for example, and make transportation pay their utilities? They can get a bill from NSP every month, and then Commissioner Molnow can decide if they're spending enough money or not on heat, for example.
Ms. Madigan, that's a decision of the legislature, basically. Right now, the function is the way it is now because that's the way it's set up.
Correct.
Just another follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Madigan. Are these leases negotiated sort of freely, where an agency will come and negotiate with you and you'll negotiate the terms of the lease, everything from price per square foot to the term of the lease, or is it kind of an adhesion contract where you basically say, this is the lease if you want to be in this building. Sign it or don't.
Ms. Madigan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think it's a combination. What we really do is we work with agencies to determine what service levels they need to operate in their facilities, and that's how the rates are developed, so that we're meeting the needs of the agency and the facility.
Any other questions on? Okay, next slide.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bev Kreuth. I'm the director of the Real Estate Management Division. We lease non-state-owned property from the private sector. One needs to recognize the differences between the way that rental rates are set in the private sector versus in state-owned buildings. As Lenora Madigan had mentioned, in our state-owned facilities, rental rates include different kinds of wage packages, indirect costs, bond interest, building depreciation. In the private sector, the rental rates are established in much the same manner with the operating expenses included, but we also have real estate taxes that are paid by the private sector, and the private sector has their profits built into those rental rates. Owner-occupied buildings focus on different things than non-owner-occupied buildings in some cases. We find that owner-occupied buildings are better maintained and that the bottom line is not on the profit mode, but on an owner occupancy and meeting the needs of the space program. And the way that we work with agencies is that if they would come to us with a need for space and tell us what their criteria was and what their program needs were, and we go out into the market and we do a market comparison of the available properties. We take into consideration rent, size, accessibility, transit needs, and the agency's budget. We tour facilities with the agencies and then make a site selection with them. After the site selection is made based on meeting their needs in the most economic manner, we begin to negotiate the lease with the landlords and do the space planning that's needed to put them into the space.
Okay, Ms. Kreuss, I have a series of questions, and I don't know if members want to chime in as time goes on, but I've been told by agency folks that they really don't have a say of where they go. It's really the Department of Administration makes the decision at the end of the day after all the criteria you laid out. Location may or may not be a situation you take into account, but you know, I noticed on the owner-occupied chart that you have that's colored here, there seems to be an obsession with the agencies about being located on or near the Capitol complex for some reason. And that is extremely expensive real estate. If you take the whole state of Minnesota and look at the whole state and the rental rates averaged out, this is probably some of the most expensive areas to be either building buildings or renting buildings that I can imagine. Maybe downtown Minneapolis, Representative Mullery, is expensive in excess of this. In some of the better suburbs. But what I would argue is that how often does admin actually take into account that you might be able to have some of these people functioning outside of the 7-county metro, where your lease or rental rates could probably be 50% plus less than what you're renting at in Roseville or in St. Paul or wherever? Is that ever taken into consideration that you might be able to locate in a Hutchinson? I'm not saying you have to be in my district even. I'm just saying maybe on a 4-lane road headed west, north, south, etc. And you know, the legislature appreciates that these folks are around, but we all have cars and we all have telephones. How often does admin actually ever look outside the metro for these things? And who ultimately makes that decision of where these people are going?
Mr. Chairman, we do have facilities that are located outside the metro area. What we take into consideration are what are the agency's needs and where do they need to deliver the services that they're delivering. It's really a collaborative effort in matching the space needs of the agency and what their services are and their delivery methods with where the real estate is, and then negotiating the most economical lease that we can. If you look at the last page of that handout, what we've shown is a map of the 7-county metro area with all of the locations where state agencies are. And then there's a blow-up here of where the concentration of our leases are, There's a huge contingency in downtown St. Paul. And then we have over in Lafayette Park, there's another contingency of agencies as well as in the Capitol area. We also have agencies located in Energy Park and in Roseville. There are some agencies that are located downtown Minneapolis. Those really are our highest rents, as you had mentioned before. If you'll notice on the left-hand side of the page, there's color coding that shows the ranges of the rental rates and how many square feet are within those rental ranges. The majority of our space, over 1.2 million, is between the $17 and the $20 range. If a comparison can be made, and you can look at the state-owned buildings, which is on the previous page, the majority of our space is between $13 and $16, so it is lower than non-state-owned space within the Capitol complex.
Now, Ms. Kreutz, if we're trying to match services and delivery with location, wouldn't it make sense that the DNR would be located in Representative Solberg's district rather than a mile east of here in one of the highest rental rates areas of the state? I understand it's $17 to $18 a foot, but at the end of the day, I would be probably more interested in the amount that we're spending per building rather than the per foot cost. Because when we were having pizza at Savoy's last night, I drove by the DNR building, and it certainly isn't small. And do you have a chart that you could get to us on all the buildings and all the leases of all these buildings? Not based on square feet, although that's helpful, but based on each building and each space that we're renting.
Mr. Chairman, yes, we can.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Solberg.
What's even more disturbing in some of these things is they closed the DNR, closed the Brainerd area, which is not my district, but the Brainerd area close to where Representative Lane is, and transferred, eliminated a couple positions and transferred the other ones down to St. Paul.
Exactly.
And into the high-rent district again. I mean, that's just one example. But, Mr. Chairman, can I ask
Representative
a couple of questions on it?
You may.
One of the things that Representative Krinke and I absolutely were joined at the hip at and almost threw up on when the administration comes with the most expensive real estate in the state, except for probably the Mall of America area, and puts the animal health laboratory on the Capitol area complex. I can't believe that, you know, Representative Greg Farmer that has a cow that dies of some mad cow disease is going to transport that animal to the area Capitol complex for testing. I mean, and their excuse was, well, we have to be close to each other. Well, you know, technology says that we don't have to be close to each other. I mean, if they would have built it at the University of Minnesota Agricultural School on the St. Paul campus, I would have been really happy with that. But my question is, as I look at the outlay of this, I want to talk about, first of all, the ag building was by law supposed to be in outside of the metropolitan area, and these are financed not by our bonding procedures but by St. Paul Port Authority. So that's how we got around that. So we didn't have a bonding bill that was big, but we're paying for it anyway. But my question is parking.
Right.
Talk to me about the ability of employees to park in this new facility when they get there.
Who wants to handle the parking issue that we are making worse by locating everybody in the same expensive area?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you are correct in identifying that there will be a parking shortage when these buildings open in the Capitol complex next fall. And we estimate at this point in time the parking shortage will be about 855 stalls. There's obviously in the bonding request a request to expand the surface lot as well as make some changes to the Centennial ramp to accommodate more of those parkers. To address the remaining shortfall, which will still exist even with the passing of the bonding bill, we're looking and working with real estate management on leasing other parking in the area in order to provide parking to employees.
Mr. Chairman, can you talk a little bit more about in the area? What that means.
So, Representative Holbrook. Ms. Madigan.
Mr. Chair, What I mean by parking in the area really is a broad range, and I am including all of downtown in that area for potential parking as well. What we've tried to do is really figure out what areas have direct bus route service, how do we facilitate people's commute to the Capitol complex, and we're working on that.
Representative Solberg.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's going to be interesting to see as a try to deal with this. This is the type of thing that should have been dealt before the building was built.
Yes.
Not after the fact. Let me just give you a little bit of history. The Stassen building is the revenue building. We had an opportunity to build that building out in Inver Grove Heights on Highway 52 and 494, whatever the highway is out there. And, of course, the powers that be wanted to have some choices, but they said that give us the choice and we're going to build it out there anyway. The minute we left town, they chose this site downtown, and I think the total cost, the additional cost of building it for the taxpayers is something like $30 million. Like $15 million, I can't remember exactly, you don't count me, but I know that there was a $15 million additional monies because we located it there instead of a couple miles away. I know it's nice to work down here, but we want to make sure that the Capitol area has that type of standard of building. I'm not complaining about that. But I am complaining about...
Solberg, who made that decision? Do you know?
Yeah.
Who at the end of the day said we need that building to be there rather than Inver Grove?
I don't want to be disparaging remarks against individuals.
Go ahead.
It was a combination of Governor Carlson and Mayor Coleman.
The plot thickens.
You notice I was kind. I said I didn't want to reveal names.
Representative
Chairman, I don't fault them for making that decision. If I was a mayor, I'd have made that decision too. But what I'm faulting is how we sometimes do the bonding bill. We're afraid to have a bonding bill, so we go around the and that's us. We go around about way and let the St. Paul Port Authority have the bonds, and we pay for them, and then we don't plan for what we need to plan for. And then also we should not at any point have that kind of a lab on the most expensive real estate in the state.
Representative Lane had a question to the point of, is it when you're bringing dead animals in? Maybe it's because we beat so many dead horses around the Capitol complex that we have to bring the dead animals in here.
Maybe not necessarily that. My question maybe wasn't quite going down that area. Just a little bit of clarification on that. We do have the diagnostic laboratory with money that we did appropriate through bonding here on past biennium that is built and is actually the utilization of space at the University of Minnesota, and I applaud them for their accountability and utilization of space that they had there already. And in my estimation, that was a good move there. I don't dispute your argument though about the Board of Animal Health building being built in the right in the Capitol complex area here. But my question actually, Mr. Chair, goes more down the lines of we've got these really nice colored maps of state-owned facilities and state-rented, non-owned areas here. And actually, Representative Solberg, you kind of spurred this to me. I would really like to see a map of the rest of the state-owned buildings across the state of Minnesota. And have a breakdown on the percentage of utilization of the amount of space that's in these buildings that are owned, especially outside the Southern County metro area. When we start looking at the Brainerd State Hospital, we've got a great number of buildings up there. It's like a little town all by itself there. And I talk with people up there, and they say there's 15 buildings up there that aren't even used. We're paying lights and heat and insurance and all the input costs. And I don't know, maybe I'm too much from the private sector, being a private business person myself, but I think the first thing that we were always taught in business was, you know, utilize the assets that you have before you go investing in more capital investments. So I mean, this is really fine and dandy, this all these colored dots on a map here, in the rates for all of this property that we're renting or owning. But at some point in time, I've got to go back to the people in my district as a representative who serves as a trustee to the state coffers and answer to them why we're building and renting property at $25 a square foot, and then we have all this building space in rural Minnesota, which we're supposed to be trying to help do some rural development, and we won't look at utilizing it. And so, Mr. Chairman, I would certainly like to ask that we could get a printout and some information on the that property in rural Minnesota.
Okay. The requests we'll have, and if you could make notes, would be, one would be on the items we have here would be, what are we spending in gross amounts on rent and lease payments? And then could we get a statewide map of all the state buildings we own? And I'm assuming Minsku is part of that, of course. And then there was a state lands report. Now, hopefully this one was supposed to be done, too, a couple years ago, correct? Representative Knobloch, Ms. Roberts, asked that there be an inventory of state land. Did that one get done?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, that one is completed, I believe.
Okay. If we could get that report, and Mr. Jordan will make copies for each of the members on that. I think we have enough interest, and Mr. Shepard is always going to be with us, so I think we're going to move state contracting off to another hearing day. The joint hearing for tomorrow will be on for us, but the Senate, because of Senator Johnson's wife's death, will be meeting earlier that day and will not be able to come over for it, but we will have joint hearings in the future. But we will still be on for tomorrow at 8:30 in room 200 for military and veterans issues, so members know we're still on for the House side. Mr. Shepard, we're going to have do state contracting at another hearing because we have enough interest in the real estate side of things. I'm interested in Representative Solberg bringing up the Port Authority for paying for this human services building. And before we get to that, Representative Mallory and Hilty had questions. Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two issues that I'd like to get into. One is, and basically because I started asking somebody who everyone on the committee would recognize as having quite a bit of financial knowledge here. The whole issue of the health building came up, and I'm wondering how often could we get an analysis done, because we put in within the last 3 years, I got the exact figures, we put in 3.9 and some change million into a building and then sold it for 4-something 3 years later. Or less than 3 years later. And I was told that this happens quite often. So I would like to get an analysis done of how much we are putting into buildings and then selling or getting rid of them soon afterwards.
Okay, there's another item for when we meet next.
The next one is, I was going to raise the issue of the, because he had pointed out to me how we are losing so much money, and maybe we're helping bail out the Port Authority for mistakes they made, but I'd just like to know that we're up front doing it. Apparently we are doing this quite often, maybe to avoid laws. It's being done by the administration, whatever. But it's costing us much more, I'm told. By the time we pay the leases, so we're getting around we can claim we're not doing the bonding, but it's costing the state taxpayers a lot more dollars, is what I'm told. And I'd like to see an analysis of what the difference would be if we would be building these buildings instead of renting from either the Port Authority or private.
When we have this future hearing, why don't we talk? Have a continuation of, we're just going to talk about rents. Would also like to know about occupancy rates for these buildings as well. Are we at capacity, or do we have excess capacity and we're renting in places we shouldn't be? Also, when these leases are expiring, are they long-term or short-term? And so we can maybe start folding some of these people in and out of other places. But this whole quagmire with the Human Services Ag building, I think we need to discuss a little bit more. There was also some interest in when we sell land, which I know that you're in charge of as well, and we didn't even touch on that yet today. There was discussion about selling land to Anoka County and so on and so forth. I think we'll probably have a hearing and just limit that topic to just real estate, but we'd like to know a little bit more about how many bidders there were on that Anoka County land and how well advertised it was and so on and so forth. Representative Hilty had a question, and then Representative Blaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to go back to Representative Solberg's question about parking in the Capitol complex. Ms. Madigan, I think what you described is the consideration of parking for employees. But presumably one of the justifications for having the Capitol complex, having all of these agencies in the same place, is for the convenience of the public. Are we considering parking for the public in planning for parking?
Ms. Madigan, do we want the public involved too?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a very good question. You're correct. I didn't point that out. Yes, we are considering the public and where public parking will be in this. And based on the information we currently know, we have several lots in the area or facilities in the area that are designed for visitor parking, as well as obviously serving the Capitol and State Office Building, which are also a popular destination of visitors.
Thank you.
Representative Blaine? Representative Finstead, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question goes back to the lease agreements, and if one of you could answer, with the different lease agreements that we have right now, what? Give me a rough percentage of those that are actually, the agreement is pretty accurate with the expenses versus how many of these lease agreements, let's say, you know, the $20 per square foot, is that meeting the expenses? Do you have a rough percentage of those that are meeting the expenses or those that are evaluated too low, too high? Does that make sense?
Chairman,
Ms.
Representative, all of the state leases are gross leases. We don't pay on a net basis, we pay on a gross basis. And that's primarily because we can't leave a lease open-ended where we don't know how much we're going to be paying for something. So the rental rates that you see on that sheet are gross amounts. They include all of the expenses for the building.
And those are state-owned and leased?
Those are leased facilities.
Okay. All right, did you have a follow-up, or Representative Blaine, are you ready for your turn?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're kind of coming to the end of the time here, and I just wanted to ask, after kind of some of the things that have transpired here this morning, where we have reports that have never been reported and then have a technology commission basically that you know, oversees all of the technology for the utilization of state government here in the state of Minnesota, that, you know, I would think in this day and age would be on the cutting edge of helping us be accountable and efficient, but can't even tell us what kind of inventory they got. I mean, this raises some pretty big concerns for myself here personally, and I think maybe we might even be on the tip of the iceberg here, which is even scarier thought. But I wanted to request, and maybe this would come from staff dumping some more work on them, but Can we get a list or a printout of all of the reports that have been mandated in the past by whether it's this committee or other purviews of state government to make sure that we're getting the information that we're supposed to be getting from these pertinent agencies? If we've got one that's not getting here, I have a sneaking suspicion there's probably others, and I think that we owe it to our people to be able to look at those.
Maybe we should just stick within the State Government Finance Committee.
Well, within the purview of this committee.
Sure. Mr. Shepherd, do you think you might be able to conjure that up?
Mr. Chair, yes. I do an annual list of all the new reports that are mandated, and then the reference library keeps a running list of all the state reports that are mandated, and I can check with them and see if they have a list of the reports that are mandated that they didn't receive.
That would be good.
And I will I'll work with them and get back to the committee.
Ms. Kreuss or one of the other witnesses, if you could also give us a list of when these leases expire on leased buildings. I know the state-owned ones are different, but how long is the DNR there for? I don't want to scare anyone, but at some point we need to take a pretty hard look at how bunched up and how expensive we want to get in terms of our leases. Representative Krinke and then Representative Solberg.
2 points, Mr. Chairman. I think Representative Blaine is going to be very busy reading the report on reports. I've looked at it before. It's an extensive list of reports, let alone going through the reports. But the other thing, Mr. Chairman, as you're asking for this information, you should probably also have the latest update of the strategic plan or the comprehensive plan that the Department Administration puts together. And when that was last updated, they usually come and ask this committee for money to update it. I don't think we've given them money to update it in a number of years. But whatever the last comprehensive plan for the capital area should probably also be in members' packets to review that. Mr. Chairman, if you're looking at doing a comprehensive or a thorough look at state-owned buildings.
Take note of that one as well. And members, we may be having a couple of evening hearings in this committee. Representative Kahn tells me she operates best at night. And I'm not going to be picky about attendance, but in some of these things, we keep running up against the clock. We have other committees that need to get in here. The real estate thing, I've had a lot of interest in that from members, I think, that we'd like to delve in, and that will very likely be an evening hearing. And what my intention would be to have them on Tuesdays or Wednesdays. We would recess the committee, not adjourn it. And therefore, if you've got meetings or, it's not in your schedule probably, Representative Mulery has a, busy life, and we don't want to force you to come in at night if you don't need to. I am here, and I'm kind of stuck here, and I've got an interest in this, but I hate to keep running up against the clock. This way we've got kind of a narrower group, but I think we're going to have a couple evening hearings as we move toward February. It's just something I think we need to do so we can spend our time on the budget and the bonding and those things during the daytime and do more of the detail work at night. Representative Mulery.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you're invited to my neighborhood meetings all the time.
You can bring your neighborhood meeting in here if it's not too raucous. Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, we're moving to February really fast. But the other thing I would be interested in is when we lease from private or own our own building, there's a point where it becomes more efficient for us to own than it is to lease, and that's always a question, because I know that the witnesses said that leasing also involves some externalities of property tax and profit as well. We understand that, but have we had an update of where that breaking point is, and is that tough to do? Of where it becomes more efficient for us to own than it is to lease?
Ms. Grace?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, we normally do a life cycle cost analysis on a case-by-case basis because you need to take into consideration the interest rate at the time, the kind of profit that somebody wants or the return on their money, and the amount of square footage and where the property is located. It's difficult to come up with a rule of thumb as far as a break-even amount because it needs to be taken on a case-by-case basis because of variances.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we can, if we have a recent analysis of that, give us
an example
of that, if you have that available, and I understand. Then the other thing I'm concerned about, sometimes the state enters into a contract that's a good per square foot rent to begin with an escalator clause in that that goes out of the site. I can give you some examples of those where we've been to that. And that's one of the things that's long-term for us to be concerned about. I don't know if we've got any examples of that or not, but what kind of escalating clauses are in leases?
Ms. Rice, Grace?
Chairman, Representative Solberg, all of our leases are gross leases, so we don't have escalator clauses in our leases precisely for that reason. And because by statute, we need to know what the costs are, so we can't agree to pay something that's unknown.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, and what is our general term of our lease? Is it 5 years, 10 years, 20?
A rough average, Ms. Price?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, they vary unbelievably, and that's because if we can get a better deal by entering into a longer-term lease, for a larger amount of space where we know an agency is going to be around, we will do that. It all depends upon the agency, what they do, what the services they deliver, where they're located, and their budget. And that really dictates the term of the lease. For larger agencies in larger spaces, we try to negotiate the best dollar we can, and we normally need to go longer term, and that's between 5 and 7 years.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. You know, not to let the cat out of the bag, but the reason my interest has been picked in this pretty heavily is my understanding is the governor's budget is going to be requesting over $20 million in new money for lease payments for this human services building, the ag building, and blah, blah, blah. And if that doesn't want to make anyone vomit, I don't know what will. So, you know, I have to justify to the people back home about why we don't have money for nursing homes and schools and everything else. So we will have probably an evening hearing on this sometime, I would guess, around mid-February. Members for the Ford building, if you have a... did you have some ideas on the Ford building tour?
Mr. Chair, I do. A couple of options tomorrow at 9. Or Friday would be even better at 9 in terms of just getting the folks we need to line up with admin. And I was also, to Representative Kahn's request, I had asked one of the University United people from a historic perspective to be there, mm-hmm. and those were the times that he could be. So if that would work out for your committee, either
way. We have a committee tomorrow, Friday, not good.
There's a funeral also.
Yeah, there's a funeral at members. We're changing session and everything for that. We have to do our bonding recs next week. So we'd like to do it before that. Is there a way where we could kind of... Military Affairs comes in at what time tomorrow? 8:30?
Yes.
But we don't have the Senate here, so obviously it'll take a lot less time. Why don't we try to do Military Affairs for maybe an hour, and maybe try to set it up for 9:30 tomorrow. It took, what, 40 minutes? Who was in on that tour last year? Representative Hilty, were you in on that?
No, I wasn't in.
I think Representative Kahn said it took about 40 minutes. Would members, if we dig into our committee time a little, or?
I think we really need to go some time.
What's tomorrow? We got a pretty full agenda tomorrow.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, let me ask a question. Everybody may not be interested in going to the Ford building. Is that a possibility we could do two things, or do we all want to be able to try to go there? Is anybody who's not interested?
Who's got a preference?
Do we need to go there? Well, Mr. Chairman, well, if you haven't
it's
been
a pretty important decision of whether we recommend to blackball the project or approve the project for the bonding committee. Because last year was blackballed, and Representative Kahn will very likely move to do that. And if you really don't know much about the building, make an informed decision. I think it would be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, what is next week
the bonding?
For when do we have to have our proposals in?
They want it by Friday the 4th. I think we were going to try to get bonding recs out of here Wednesday. Could we shoot for Monday or Tuesday at some time of convenience? What's scheduled on the docket for Tuesday during committee time? We will do a review of our bonding items that are before the committee on Tuesday. That shouldn't take very long. So why don't we take committee time? We'll convene at 8:15. We'll probably go for a half hour. And then why don't we try to shoot for, 9:00, something like that for Tuesday. We'll do it during committee time so we don't have members saying, well, I don't know anything about the Ford building and all that.
Mr. Chair, so Tuesday, 8:45 would work out best for the committee.
Why don't we shoot for that and then have people here and we'll walk through the tunnel and take a look.
Mr. Chair, now on the tunnel is closed. That was one of the questions out of the committee. It's closed because of the non-occupancy status of the building.
Okay.
So...
But someone's got a key.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a safety thing.
No. Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative, no, we do have keys.
We're pretty hepped up on the whole going through the tunnel thing because of how cold it is. So we'd really like to go through that if we could.
Mr. Chair, if I could just suggest, could I work with Mr. Jordahl on
nailing down
the details and where we would meet and probably be at the East Store.
Anything for the good of the cause yet? Okay, meeting's adjourned.